Join us on the steps of 36, a question and answer conversation that crosses the thresholds into the histories, lives, influences, and stories of the person and figure behind their work. A podcast by RAA at the Architectural Association.
Hello and welcome to On the Steps of 36, a podcast by RAA at the Architectural Association. Today we're joined by Mohammed El-Shahed, a writer, curator, and critic of architecture. In 2011, he founded Cairo Observer, a fluid project with six printed magazines distributed for free to stimulate public debates around issues of architecture, heritage, and urbanism. He is the author of Cairo Since 1900, An Architectural Guide, and was the curator of the Cairo Modern Exhibition at New York Center for Architecture, as well as Modernist Indignation, Egypt's Pavilion at the 2018 London Design Biennial, and now of the British Museum's Modern Egypt Project. He's joining us today for this podcast while also speaking as part of the Beyond Eurocentrism Rethinking the Architectural Canon Symposium at the AA. So, Mohammed, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back at the AA.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. I think the last time you were here was in 2018.
It was a good year.
It was
a difficult year, but a good year.
And so much has happened since. So to start with, could you tell us your full name and star sign?
Mohammed El-Shahed, and I'm a Leo.
No, Leos are wonderful, generous people.
So. You know, big-hearted. And yeah. I literally discovered only very recently that I actually have a slightly oversized heart. And I was like, okay, so it's written in the stars.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God, that's such a lovely way to put it. And where did you grow up?
So my growing up process has a bit of Kuwait up until the Gulf War of 1990, Egypt, and then immigration to New Jersey, lived in the northeast of the U.S. And then, I guess that's my growing up part. Yeah, so at least three continents, a little bit of Asia, a little bit of Africa, a little bit of the U.S.
Nice. Yeah. And did you have a nickname then, or do you still?
When I was a kid, I was Mimi.
That's cute.
A lot of Egyptian Muhammads become Mimis. And then as I had sort of, engaged in what's going on publicly in programs and so on, people just called me Shahid, which is my last name without the E-L, and it stuck. I didn't choose it. So I have like a given name as a child and then a given name as an adult, I suppose. I like both of them.
Yeah.
I'll so respond to Mimi still, yeah. If anybody cared to call me Mimi.
I love it. I want to start calling you that.
Yeah, Mimi, hey. Well, you want to tell us about decolonization?
Yeah.
Decolonize my nickname, yeah. Please.
Sounds like the name of a good podcast.
Yeah.
And what was the typology of the home you grew up in?
Always apartments. Apartment in Kuwait, ground floor. Apartment in Alexandria, Egypt, first floor up, in a building that my grandfather built.
Nice.
And New Jersey was, again, ground floor apartment. Always apartments. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love apartments.
I love apartments, too,
yeah.
As someone who grew up in one. And how many of you lived together in those apartments?
So my family is five total. We were all five in Kuwait, I guess in Alexandria as well. There were times when my older sister wasn't around, so four to five, I would say. It depends on when and where.
And did you have a favorite toy as a child?
Ooh, there was this thing called Mechanico. I don't know. I think it was a pretty international game. It had like these perforated metal parts that you can assemble with screws and build things.
Oh, cool. Very architectural.
Yeah, so I guess it was early on. And Legos, of course. But I also liked to, when I was a kid, I definitely have a very clear memory of building my own, like out of cardboard, like kind of maze type of things, you know. So made my own toys.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm conscious I'm depriving you of lunch to record this podcast, but were there any foods that you refused to eat when you were young?
When I was young, okra was not very attractive because of the gooiness, but I love it now.
Same.
And sheep. I saw during one of the Eids, sheep being slaughtered, and I was like, I am not touching that for the rest of my life.
And have you stuck to it?
Yep, I don't eat it.
I can imagine that must be quite traumatic.
I don't prefer meat in general. Now, the older I get, the body just doesn't want it, honestly. But definitely that one stuck. Yep, no sheep.
Yeah. I think that's probably an image printed on your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your favorite place to visit during childhood?
Beach. always the beach. It still is. Any beach. Almost any beach. I mean, certain beaches obviously have more an affinity, but the beach was always the favorite.
Nice. So moving away from the beach and more towards work, what would you describe what you do as?
Oh, ruffle feathers? I don't know.
Oh my God, I like that as like a job title.
That's my job
title. Feather ruffler.
Yeah, exactly.
Mimi the feather ruffler.
The autobiography.
Yeah. Can't wait.
I mean, I don't know. I architecture is obviously at the center of my interests. I've always been someone who, I didn't have incentives to, I think, commit to the way I was taught a lot of things. So when it didn't seem like it fit intellectually, spiritually, mentally, however way, emotionally, you know, all of these other things, I would sort of walk around it. So if it's architecture, if it's design, it's always been an interest in what humans make, spatially, specifically, in particular, I mean. But I guess it's, I never stuck to a career path. A lot of people would be like, you know, why don't you stay on a campus and teach somewhere? That never appealed. Also, realities didn't necessarily make that attractive. Why didn't you practice? Well, there are reasons for that as well, but I love architecture. So I think because of a critical voice, or a voice that's perceived from usually outsiders as critical, for me is just saying what I see. I would say I'm someone who talks about architecture and the built environment and people and the things that people make, but always never forgetting my position in seeing and experiencing these things. Because I think a lot of people adopt narratives that are fed to them through education or other means. So that would be how I would make sure that it's about the things people make, but it's also always remembering my position and not sidelining that to sort of serve the profession or to serve a narrative.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not the most straightforward way to say it, but...
No, I think it's really fascinating and also really inspiring probably for a lot of people to see how you've pursued a kind of non-traditional career path, but been very successful at kind of drawing people's attention to things that are otherwise going unnoticed, or building momentum behind a kind of maybe the preservation of historic fabric, or thinking about ways we operate in the present. And I was just curious as to how you kind of carved out that space to do what you do and how it's continued to evolve over time.
I mean, it's partially circumstantial, and then I wouldn't want to give circumstances all the power and force and shape in my life, but obviously that is what one has to grapple with. Having had a childhood where I wasn't rooted in one place, I mean, it's very difficult for me to compare notes with someone, let's say, who's always been in one geography. So the world, their picture of the world is always created out of that one position, and let's say has access to certain kind of privilege or education that then enforces their views. That wasn't my experience. So it's going to be very difficult. Why would you imagine that myself and someone who had that kind of background should sit at the same table and see eye to eye? So I think having had that, you know, a foot in one world and a foot in another, moving around, again, you know, the Gulf War is something way beyond me and my family, but it shaped my trajectory. I still say that I'm still at 42, 30 years later, still living the consequences of 1990. And that's probably actually true. So the short answer to how I maybe carved my way, because when I'm in it, I don't think I'm carving my way. I'm usually thinking I'm survival, you know. But to maintain a certain kind of integrity to my own voice, because I do think, you know, you're born as you. So you better, you know, don't...
Stay true to it.
Stay true to it. You know, there isn't another one of you. Nothing is really worth that, you know. So stay true to yourself.
It's a good kind of reminder to us all.
Yeah, go for it. Don't sell out.
Very important time to hear that message. And other than a phone or laptop, what are the tools that you'd say you work with in your practice?
So I guess always it was, I always used to write notes about thoughts, you know, and just have a stack of notebooks from sort of the grad school up until maybe just a few years ago. And then that sort of, I let go of that, even that. So I feel like with time, and also my own personal evolution or whatever, I've become less attached to tools, actually. It also means a lot of really, in the moment, seeming good ideas just evaporate really quickly. So it's a challenge. I don't know. I'm not a tool-based person, let's just say.
Yeah, I think that's totally valid. And also, I don't know, I'm always worried about forgetting things, and increasingly I'm forgetting more things. Mm. But I feel like a really good idea will find its way back to you. So. Yeah,
you know, I have to say, one of the, you know, because you mentioned the laptop and the phone, of course. I mean, sometimes I catch myself almost afraid to put it down because of the strange insecurity that we've become accustomed to. You know, there's a sense that there's a kind of a watching eye all the time. So sometimes those tools that have become systemic in our lifestyles and the way we work and think, for me, has kind of become almost like, oh, don't put that down. You know, like, there is a sense that you are no longer in control of your own, well, thoughts in a way, in the sense of the insecurity that comes with these technologies, just feeling that there's a watching eye. I mean, I sometimes wish I was a writer, like a Hemingway type writer with a typewriter in somewhere in Cuba with no internet. That would be amazing.
Yeah. You know. And also, remember in 2018, you talked a lot about these amazing Arabic alphabet typewriters that you had discovered. And I've been kind of obsessed with them ever since.
I've been thinking about them recently because that's what I'm writing about now. Yeah. So, yeah. I wish I had one of those.
This could be the future.
Maybe.
And so where would you say, I guess you operate across different spaces, but what's the space you typically work in? Look like?
So I would always refer back to my favorite workspace that I created for myself, which didn't last for as long as I would have thought. I had in my apartment in Cairo, I created a beautiful office space. It was the first time in my life where I gathered things that I left sort of in a trail as I traveled. You know, if I did a postdoc in Berlin, I left some things there. If I was studying in New York, I had some things in storage. So for the first time, I gathered everything in one apartment, and my office was just a little heaven. I mean, that's where I wrote my Kairos's 1900 book. And, you know, a lot of the material that I got published. And, you know, that was ideal because it had good light, wood floor, it was all my books, and so it was already noisy visually because of the books and little knickknacks that I collected throughout my life. But I would just say the most important thing is to have my material, have light and wood floors. I think those, and my dog doesn't hurt either. But I mean, that would be kind of an ideal workspace. If the beach is not too far away, yeah. That would be even better.
Oh my God, the dream.
I mean, yeah. I mean, who doesn't want that?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, you've written this amazing book that so many people have referenced. You are writing a book right now. But is there a particular book that has had a significant impact on the way you approach your work?
Ooh, there are definitely books that one comes across that sort of obviously do what books should do, you know, when they're good, which is kind of an aha moment. It's really hard to only give credit to one in particular.
You could have multiple.
I want to say a controversial answer, but I'm going to not say it.
Well, you can't like say that and then not say it.
Well, in the current political and cultural environment, you know, I think this could be misread. But I'll actually say it because I don't want to refer to a history book or something that some other human being wrote. Personal crises do shape us. And I found myself as an adult actually opening random pages of the Quran. I know this is not what you expected, but it has helped me tremendously. And, you know, I think people have such narrow boxes for who you are that if you say something like that, it would be kind of like, oh, but like, aren't you gay and open? And, you know, what are you doing? Like, why would you even refer that? But like, sorry, I don't fit somebody else's reductive, profile of who I am. But actually, that's been tremendously helpful in the last few years. I don't read it systemically, but it has come, moments of inspiration have come through it very unexpected ways.
Yeah, and I think
that actually fed back into my work because it's about, you know, questions that are really just about the big picture.
Yeah, and I think it's the power of books like that to reach out to you at a time when you really need it for you to interpret it. But also I think so much of how people gatekeep religion or think it's for some people and not for others is kind of human-made.
Yeah, I mean, just read it as a work of literature. You know, you don't have to obsess about the religious dimension of it. I mean, whatever. I mean, I've referred to, for my own personal growth, to, you know, religious texts that came from everywhere, you know, Hinduism and Jyoti. Kabbalah is like a huge, I mean, that's not something you're supposed to say either, but like I spent the last 3 years, you know, kind of obsessing about it. And those are things that actually like kind of open up headspace when you're talking about something totally different, because it just provides another tool, another perspective, you know, something that's a bit more essential about human dynamics, power, you know, these stories do, they're there, they've survived for a reason, and they're useful for us to reflect on, whether you're writing about architecture or psychology.
Exactly.
I think it's useful.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this thing of them like transcending time is what makes them so powerful.
Absolutely.
Because they, you interpret them in different ways depending on the time in which you read them.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, my whole conception of time itself has transformed because of being able to, just like I geographically, I had my life had to be in different places, intellectually, I think that's why I have very much ease to dabble a little bit of in Buddhism and, you know, whether it's Alan Watts' interpretation of it or some, you know, something a little bit more rooted in the original kind of interpretation or Hinduism or Kabbalah or, you know, Islamic mysticism. I mean, like, I navigate those comfortably. I don't have kind of an itch about it. Like, oh, don't go there.
I mean, this is just going to like take over the whole podcast now, because
yes,
I feel like
I can
talk about this
totally,
all day.
I mean, I can talk about this all day.
but I think, yeah, it's so resonant because I really feel like religion is used as a way to divide so many people today, and your ability to navigate through all these different beliefs, ideas, ideologies is perhaps a really important, I don't want to say tool, but methodology that could help us deal with so many of the crises we're facing today.
Yes. I mean, I would say that the picture of the world has been painted to us with what's been called European Enlightenment. Modernity has failed in absolutely many visible and clear ways. and so it doesn't hurt to, well, to step back from those assumptions that came with that project, which is persisting. It's like insistence, like we must keep going. You know, there is a certain, it's almost militaristic in its procession forward, as if nothing, you know, it can be affected by anything. Anyways, I mean, I do think it's people, architects would benefit from reading, exposing themselves more to historians, psychologists, and, well, architects can benefit from reading more psychology. I mean, that's something that helped me a lot in the last few years as well, in my own personal life, but also in how I reflect that, because I can't separate the two. I mean, going back to this whole professional carving one's own path, I think by sticking to one's own dignity and perspective, well, it becomes impossible to really separate what you do and who you are. And I think a lot of the modern assumptions that came with this post-Enlightenment European project, it means you're a person who can be made into different things, and the good ones make themselves one thing or another, and then, you know, there's a separation. There's your public life, there's your personal life. For me, real life experience has taught me completely the opposite, you know, completely entangled. Who I am, what I say, what I write, are totally blended.
Yeah, and I think that's what is also so exciting about practicing or operating today, is that I feel like in the past, everyone was having to conform to a way of working, whereas now your identity shapes so much, or can shape so much, of how you choose to work and what you choose to do. And that blurring you speak about is what's so exciting, I find. So if there was one technological device that you could invent, what would it be?
A narcissist detector.
Oh my God, that's such a good one.
Right? Like, where is that on the market?
Yeah.
The marketplace is made by narcissists. That's why they don't make those things. I mean, obviously such a thing wouldn't exist, but I mean,
could exist.
Well, it could. But I mean, actually, it's a good question, because it also hopefully should help us, you know, realize the limitations of the technologies that we can make, because these are the kinds of real life forces that you can't just make a computer to fix, you know, so there is a limit.
No, and it goes back to what you were saying about the relationship between like architecture and psychology and things like that. Like through going to therapy, we develop ways of detecting this
Absolutely. I mean, Le Corbusier, let's take that, the most sort of monumental figure, I guess, that you learn as a student about. I mean, it sounds like he was not a nice guy, you know? And yeah, so it took me much, much later in my own personal education outside of the classroom to discover things like his political positions, that he was willing to work for fascism, but also for the reconstruction of France after the war. I mean, he was also, in a way, willingly kind of a part of the colonialist machinery, one can say, both within Europe, actually, and outside of it. So, you know, that's a psychological issue. That's not a design issue, but that's not what gets taught in history books. When you look at form plans and sections and then portraits of the guy posing next to his works, and then you sort of have a godlike image of these people. But at the end of the day, they're real people. You know, they have love and hate. The issues with control or not, and blah, blah, blah. So I think, yeah, sure, of course, these things are... I'd like to know that when I learn about someone.
Me too.
Kind of a more human-centered approach to education about these figures would be much more interesting. You know, bring in a little bit of biography in there as opposed to... Because otherwise we just get gods, you know.
Yeah, and we almost put them on pedestals
exactly.
That maybe they don't always deserve or is maybe not useful for anyone in the study of architecture.
Absolutely. And I mean, those pedestals are made by the historian. The historian is the pedestal maker in the Western tradition of architectural history. It's like, who's going to be on a pedestal and who's not? Said Karim, someone that I admired, even though he seems to have had his own problems, with power, and you know, he was decided by many people, because many people could have decided to treat him equally, to not be on a pedestal. So you end up with this very made up, literally a virtual reality, really, but except it's in our real reality, what we think of as our real reality, who gets appreciated and who doesn't, and usually the ones that get appreciated, then we see it before our eyes, you know, presidents are treated this way, even though they can be doing and saying crazy things, the official narrative, which is what's going to end up in the biography, which is what's going to end up being, you know, the biopic on Netflix in 20 years, is not that person. I don't know how I got to this side
narcissist
point.
Detector.
But it's narcissist detector. That would be a device probably impossible to make and very easily misused by probably actual narcissists.
Yeah.
So probably good that we can't make such a thing. But I mean, like yeah. I said, it points to the limitations of the things that we can make to help us in the world.
And maybe an important note to our listeners is to be a feather ruffler rather than a pedestal maker.
Oh my God, I love that.
So, where do you live now?
At the moment, I live in Paris, although it's a temporary stay for a fellowship. And before that and after will be Mexico City.
Nice. Wow, now I'm spoiled for choice about what city to base my next question on. I guess you can choose. But is there one hidden space that you would recommend for us to visit in either Paris or Mexico City?
So Paris, you know, I've visited before. First time to live there. And I feel like I don't know it. you know, I was, it's a very strange experience to be in a place, but not be in it in the way that I felt with Mexico City, for example. Mexico City was much easier for me to integrate myself into and to explore, spend hours and hours on foot, just walking around and trying to take as much of it in. And there, I can think of a few hidden places. I mean, there's this like decrepit, choo-choo train in a park station, a choo-choo train station in the Central Park, in the big Central Park in Central Mexico, with these beautiful concrete domes lifted by these purple thin metal columns, and it's kind of overgrown by plants because that choo-choo train is not working anymore. You know, those are the kinds of moments when you just stumble upon it and you're like, what is that? I can think of a lot of those, maybe not a lot at the moment, like off the top of my head, but there's definitely a lot of those that I've encountered in Mexico. I wish, and I think, you know, actually it probably has to do something with like Paris being Paris. Paris is like the modern city sort of embedded, you know, in the sense that it was like wiped out, replanned, you know. Well, that also makes it for me a much less exciting place to discover, to be honest. I find it not as exciting visually and experientially as a place like Mexico City or Cairo, but that might be a personal preference.
Yeah, but I could totally, I mean, maybe just because I think similarly, I think I could totally see how that would be the case. And just hearing that description of the choo-choo train, I'm going to take you up on your invitation to come visit you when you go back there.
I must have a picture somewhere. I'll send it to
you. Yes, please. And what would you say is your favorite building currently in existence?
In existence, it's always hard, again, for the same reason of the person in the book, to not put one. You know, the first thing that came to mind, honestly, were these suspended cabins that were constructed in the 50s east of Alexandria. And it was meant to be a beach resort for the masses, but in reality, it was for the new middle class that came out after the Republic was established. But there were these beautiful kind of wave-like structures, concrete, with cubic components that then are the cabins within it. Totally fallen apart, decrepit today. Most likely will not exist for much longer. But it's, and we don't know specifically the name of the architect. I mean, those are the buildings I'm attracted to. The ones that are, that kind of instantly feel like that must have been something to experience when it was new. But at the same time, even as a specialist historian, someone interested in sort of the histories of these things, can't find out the name of the person. I'm more attracted to that. Sometimes the anonymous, but impressive, but also decrepit because it's been anonymous and fallen apart over a long period of time. Somehow that becomes more interesting for me.
Yeah. And I think also, I don't know, there's something in like maybe how things are shaped by multiple hands over time that needs to be given more credit rather than being obsessed with authorship.
Oh, authorship is kind of the death of a lot of things in many ways. You know, I think when people get obsessed about whether in the making or in the writing of histories about it, when we center authorship, which, you know, in a culture that commodifies ideas, you know, one can take another perspective and say, well, we're all, you know, let's take a, whatever you want to call this. But like, if consciousness and ideas are, you know, floated in a certain way and shared by people and has always been, you know, that would be one way to explain why a certain habit or pattern can pop up and appear historically in so many different geographies, but not because they were in communication, but because they, well, people just thought, let's do the same thing here and here and here and there. That's very counter to the modern idea that modernity comes from one point and then spread out. So even, and we monetize then those ideas because they're authored by supposedly one person. And then, well, that person then owns, you know, it's just, so authorship kind of, it's itself a child of this messy thing that we call modernity that we're refusing to let go of somehow. Not to say to not be modern anymore, but to let go of the way of thinking that modernism has shipped us into, one of which is to center authorship.
Yeah. And if you could visit one piece of architecture that no longer exists, as someone who's like actually really been fighting, especially in Cairo, to kind of place value on some of these historic buildings that aren't being conserved, what would it be?
Well, you know, in the process of writing my book about Cairo, which was motivated mostly by seeing before my eyes a lot of architecture being wiped out without record, in the process of writing the book, something like a dozen buildings were demolished. A dozen buildings that were included in the book.
Oh, wow.
So when I started the book, it was still standing by the time the book was finished. That's how quickly the onslaught is. I mean, some of them can be as minor as an interesting gas station in downtown Cairo that had a really beautiful kind of roof design and sort of pilotis supporting that roof that just, you know, no longer there. There was a Shell station that I'm thinking of in my head. So something like that would be the kind of thing that you wouldn't even think about. worthy of history, unless we're talking about, well, the gas station in the American landscape. Well, that has many books on it. You know what I mean? But the modernist gas station in downtown Cairo, who cares about that? So those are the kinds of things that pop up at a certain moment in history, disappear. You know, the way I think about buildings, I don't assume a very kind of Western British, even, you know, you can go to Oxford today and look at pictures from, you know, when photography started, and it might look the same. There's a kind of a stability, you know. I come from a context in which buildings have a very clear birth and death dates, you know. So again, if I were to name one, it would be, you know, too difficult because there's so many. But I would just use the opportunity of the question to say that it might be worth remembering sort of nothing is last, you know, nothing is forever, and not humans, nothing humans make. And so buildings are, especially the geographies that I deal with, have very short shelf lives. So that itself is worth reflection.
Definitely. And I think in the spirit of like this transience, but also in the gas station, if you could select one vehicle to travel around the world in, what would it be?
My feet. But after that, probably a bicycle, and after that, a train.
Okay, it's good order.
I'll get too tired on a bicycle if that was how I actually travel around the world. So probably train, but I do enjoy bikes. Yes, walking is my favorite.
Same. What building material do you think is ugly and despised?
Cladding. What the hell? What has our architecture come to? You know, it's just, it's been such a normalized thing, I guess. You know, you create some sort of structure and then you clad it with some, it just seems so counterintuitive. Well, besides, a lot of these materials are just environmentally awful. In their making and in their existence once they're made. But I just think aesthetically, it's very counterintuitive from even the modern idea, which is, you know, you what you see is what you get. Cladding is totally opposite to that. I just think it's always been hideous from my perspective.
Yeah, and there's like a fakeness to it of like the building's trying to be something they're not in so many ways.
That building that burned here in London, wasn't that a cladding issue, right? Yeah, so it just seems to, you know, there are these moments, you know, like that fire here in London, you know, that could be someone could center that as a sort of an iconic moment to write a whole history of why cladding came about and it shouldn't be used anymore, you know, something like that. But
like the kind of Pruitt-Igoe moment for cladding.
Exactly.
It really should be, because it's spawned a whole cladding crisis across the UK where the same cladding was used on so many buildings, and now there's a real problem of how to get rid of it.
Yeah, but then, you know, even the aftermath was so interesting because it was all about like legalities, and you know, it wasn't about the architecture as architecture. It was like, it wasn't questioning why do we use this thing that some industrialist somewhere thought like, oh, that'll be a great way to make money. I'm just going to make, you know, parts in a factory that we can cover everything with. You know, it's not good.
Definitely. So I guess now moving to culture, what is your favorite restaurant in Paris?
Oh, geez. Because I've been living in Mexico before where there is no Middle Eastern food, I'm loving the fact that Paris has, you know, Turkish and Lebanese, and also like everyday kind of shawarma stalls, you know, but some of them are really delicious. So again, I'm just such an anti-hierarchical person. It's so deep in my like when you want to do when I just like I can never give you one answer, but like yeah, I would just say that category of food outlets, the simple, everyday but delicious by immigrants. That
delicious
sounds good to me.
Yeah.
And they're usually friendlier. So
exactly.
Yeah.
What do you consider to be your perfect meal?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind always is fish.
It's part of the beach theme.
It's just the beach theme. It's, you know, growing up, you know, fish. I mean, a well-cooked piece of fish will always win in my taste buds situation. Yeah.
And what was the last cultural event that you attended? That can include going to the cinema.
So two come to mind. Both of them were in Mexico. I was there over the holidays. I went to the Museum of Modern Art in Mexico City, which I think it's still there, a big exhibition on brutalism in Mexico.
Oh, wow.
So that was really exciting. Again, I mean, coming from Egypt and working on the Middle East, which is not going through a good moment in history, to be able to not go to London or Paris, but instead to a city like Mexico City, which has a lot more in common somehow, you know, the political history, the economic history, and to see them being able to come to terms with their own histories, source enough material to put on an exciting exhibit. You know, it's a government-funded exhibit. Oh, I can't dream about that in most places anymore. So government-funded, public, accessible, free on Sundays, beautiful models, you know, not too gimmicky. You know, that excites me. You know, the theme of brutalism itself is maybe not the most exciting part about it, but it's just the fact that here's a theme, we're going to do our own history. Well done, nice framing, you know, like the photography is well done, the models, you know, that was exciting for me to see. And then on that same trip, I went to the Cineteca, the National Cinema Center in Mexico City, for what ended up being a free screening of an Egyptian movie, which I was like, this is strange. And it was full house in the middle of the day, on like a weekday of a film called The Cairo Conspiracy that came out in 2022, which is like banned in Egypt. And here it was in this massive theater in Mexico City in the National Cineteca, full house. So that was exciting. I would count that as a cultural event.
Yeah.
Mostly not just for the film, but to watch all these Mexicans interested in watching that, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting how, you know, we, even in cities where we didn't grow up or aren't necessarily from, that we find these moments of belonging, like from the shawarma stand to watching this film in a cineteca in Mexico City.
Totally, yes.
There's this amazing kind of resonance of culture that kind of traverses borders.
Absolutely,
really
absolutely, yes. And it's nice, it's always for me nice to see South-South appreciation.
Yeah.
Because that alone seems to be almost like a rebellious act, you know what I mean? Again, it was exciting. The film was interesting, but it was more exciting for me to just watch a big movie theater filled with Mexicans in the middle of the day on a weekday, engulfed in this movie. I was like, wow, you know, that's that kind of South-South. It's a form of solidarity, actually. I mean, if film distribution would work a different way than it does now and doesn't just push Hollywood and action and so on, and Egyptians can also watch Mexican movies and appreciate, you know, like if we live in that kind of world, well, how exciting, you know?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I've been trying to watch more Indian cinema in the UK, and it's been really hard to try and find places to do that unless you go to a neighborhood where there is a big diaspora population. Yeah. But like someone I know runs this kind of film club where he's actually trying to pair kind of old Hollywood movies with like old Bollywood or even South Indian films and stuff. And it's been really fascinating to see how that kind of brings in a very diverse audience that isn't just Indian people.
Yeah.
But like it kind of builds these unusual connections.
Yes. I mean, it's exciting. I just one point on that. I had a residency in Brazil in 2017. And part of the programming that everybody was asked to come up with programming. So I also brought in an Egyptian film and we screened it at a movie theater. But it was fascinating while there in the moment to realize that these Brazilians wouldn't have watched this Egyptian film if it wasn't for whoever brought me for this residency. And who was it? The Goethe Institute. So we live in a world in which, you know, again, the Germans need to bring the Egyptians and the Brazilians together on their terms. Yes, sure, we have a facade of do whatever you want. But at the end of the day, economically, I wouldn't have been able to go and spend, you know, a month and a half, 2 months in a city in Brazil, organized for a film screen, and if it wasn't, the Germans paying for it. But that became when the Brazilians get to encounter an Egyptian film. So, I mean, again, those kind of South-South spectatorship in a way you know, allows, well, for one to see just things differently. And I wish we had more opportunities for that.
Well, maybe to be optimistic, maybe that the Goethe Institute may have been the catalyst, but maybe having seen that, there may be new opportunities in the future to build those connections.
Hope so.
And I guess it's like a perfect segue to the next question, which is if you could inhabit one film, what would it be? Another kind of choice to pick a singular.
Well, that one is easier, actually. That one is easier. I mean, so I recently met probably what I would say is one of my two favorite directors ever, Alejandro Jodorowsky, who made The Holy Mountain, but also still made films in the last decade about his life, the biographical films. He made The Endless Poetry and what was the other one? The Dance of Reality. Those were made in the 2010s.
And also like his, I guess, Dune, his unfinished project.
And his unfinished
Dune, incredible,
which became famous recently because of Dune. But really, those films are real. I mean, I would love to live within the Holy Mountain. I mean, I looked at the photos, I watched the film, and I'm like, how did they pull that off? And with that budget and in that time, and it's just like, wow, it's incredible. Insistence on realizing a vision, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to. And then the other one, so my other favorite director is the Egyptian Yusuf Shaheen. They're very different, but both of them were very interested in their lives, made autobiographies with like a twist of fantasy. So Yusuf Shaheen made a film, was it like 1982 or something like that, where most of the film takes place in a set that looks like his ribcage.
Oh, wow.
And it's a courtroom where family members are feuding over who's the reason why he's dead. That was the kind of the, and so the whole movie is him in a hospital undergoing heart surgery. And then in while, you know, so all of this is happening now within
in
him.
In his body. Yeah.
In his body, in his mind, basically. And the, wow, I mean, what a stretch of fantasy that's so grounded in reality at the same time.
Which is kind of interesting parallel between the two directors, maybe. It's great.
It's called An Egyptian Story, if I remember correctly.
I'm going to check it out. Yes. And what's your favorite television show?
Does Netflix count?
Yeah, totally.
Because I can't remember the last time I actually watched television. I mean, when I was younger in the U.S. and you can't escape it, because television is such a...
Yeah.
I mean, this is how you become American, I guess. You watch a lot of television. You know, the things that I liked were like, The Price is Right. I don't know. just like, wow, what are these people doing? You know, I was fascinated. But like, I guess more recently, the two shows on Netflix in the last maybe 5-6 years that I saw that I thought were interesting were Sense8. It's just, I like the premise. It's playful, and there's like storylines from different parts of the world who like share visions, and then they become this like super team. I don't know. It's something about it that I feel like the foundations of the show are based on a different perception of what reality is, and I like that to begin with, as opposed to superimposing a storyline over like a very outdated notion of what reality is. I like that. And then the other show on Netflix that I thought was interesting was Messiah, which came out like, I guess, what, during the pandemic or something like that, and it was supposed to have a second season and didn't. And I find it interesting because it has like an Iranian main figure as the, what I guess is the Messiah, and it has scenes in which you see the abuses of Israeli intelligence, you know, on a Palestinian kid. And this happened, you know, those on Netflix, which is, you know, most of which, there are documentaries about this right now, are shows that are sort of approved by the military-industrial complex. That's the kind of network it is, or, you know. So it's interesting that a show like that made it on that platform, but it's not also surprising why they didn't do the sequel that was supposed to happen.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. I'm going to check both of those out, because I haven't watched either.
I hope it's not embarrassing that I share this.
No, not at all. Oh, my God. And what was the first album that you ever bought?
I wish I had a confirmed memory of it, but it was most likely Michael Jackson Bad.
It's very danceable.
Or Dangerous. One of the two. It was Michael Jackson, Madonna, Janet Jackson, and Metallica. That's the kind of kid I was.
I mean, I was a big Metallica fan.
This
in
is
my
like
youth.
1992 or something, Alexandria, you know.
Yeah. I feel like that's a good...
somehow, that makes sense.
Off that time.
Yeah.
And what's the best gig you've ever been to?
I don't know about the best, but I think the best gigs in general are the ones that get my emotions growing. And I cried at a Smashing Pumpkins concert recently. Oh, again, is this turning into a therapy session?
Yeah.
I mean, but, I would call that a good gig.
Yeah.
You know, if it like drove some emotional response out of me, that makes it a good gig for
definitely.
Me.
Definitely. I don't know whether you'll be happy about admitting that to everyone who might listen to this, but it's great.
Hey, Smashing Pumpkins were pretty cool. They still are. I still listen to them every day. Almost, yeah.
And what's your favorite album or playlist now?
Well, actually, the favorite album relates right to what I just said, because I adore by the Smashing Pumpkins, like 1997. I mean, my relationship to music is interesting, because I've been listening to a lot of my music from those years. And I think something happened with just the music industry where, well, I guess you just go back to the 90s, because that's where it sounds like somebody's saying something because they want to say it, they believe it, they felt it, you know, as opposed to record studio kind of made up stuff with just a bunch of beats laid over it. Anyways, but Adore by the Smashing Pumpkins, 1997, something like that was, it still is, I would say, my favorite album. Machina, that came after that. Machina 2, which wasn't released. I mean, they're an independent band somehow, which I appreciate very much, I guess, being independent myself.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, lyrics then were just so powerful.
Oh,
and like,
the
I feel
lyrics.
Like,
yes.
I mean, I probably know every lyric to every song that was popular when I was growing up. And I probably don't know any lyrics to any songs now.
Absolutely. Same.
But I never thought of it in the way you just said it, that potentially it's because it's all kind of studio made as opposed to people having something to say.
Oh my God, it's expression versus production, really.
It's a great way of putting it. So I guess moving to politics, although we've talked a lot about politics across this these questions.
Oh, don't twist my arm.
So much of the discussion in today's symposium, at least this morning, has been about the exchange of knowledge and the power that accompanies it across contexts. And what I've always found really fascinating about your work is how it definitely deals with time. Mm. And you've been talking about that a lot in our conversation even just now. So not looking at the impact of colonialism on the kind of Middle East and North African region through the kind of historical lens, but actually really thinking about the impact of it through the lens of today, where you don't often have the benefit of hindsight, but you're really watching something play out live. And I think it's something that you do especially well in the work that you've done and continue to do. And I was just wondering if you could speak more about the ways in which you've developed doing this, but also why it's so important to kind of situate that kind of thinking in the now.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's maybe a less straightforward one for me to answer because it's an ongoing thinking process. And I grapple with time almost on a daily basis right now in these months and years we've been living since 2020 in particular, A, because we had a lot of time to sit around and reflect, at least some of us. But also the unfolding events really kind of expose that the established notion of linear time has really, again, failed us to grapple with our realities. You know, what I was trying to say in the session just before about how stories can be nonsensical when they're produced from a certain perspective. So, for example, the easy one for me to give an example with is A Land Without a People. That's a story. That's someone's story. For those who know, they always knew that this makes no sense. But we're watching that story become facts on the ground where Land Without a People. So, and, you know, our perception of time in the limited duration of a human life doesn't operate, you know, you cannot base that as how history is then remembered, written, documented, and so on. Because, you know, I always say, you know, a century, like the last century, devastating for a region like the Middle East. But in geological time, it's like a blip, you know, in terms of the planetary time, it's nothing. So I think it's just important, you know, a lot of people are too, and I think part of the life that we're living with this machinery of the economy, that the economy drives a certain kind of machinery in our lives where we're too, you know, when you have to think about the next payment for your credit card and then the loan and then this other thing and the other thing, your sense of time is totally distorted by these externally imposed things. I'm not saying they're not real or important. I'm just saying it doesn't have to be that way, nor do they have to dominate your sense of time. You know, most people's sense of time in the modern life that we live in, if you're in a North Atlantic city at least, is, you know, like my bill payments, you know, like you literally, so it's like the month, you know, the month by month and everything based on that. And well, within a century, you can transform a whole landscape just with a bunch of stories that can, again, start like nonsense for those in the know. But by the end of the century, while everybody was busy paying their bills and just obsessing about the, you know, the next thing, you know, the very different scale of time, that becomes a reality. No one will remember that it was never a reality before. So I guess like past, present, and future, you know, maybe this is why I'm also very interested in, you know, other traditions, because not everybody thinks of, or thought of time as linear, as a progression. And it affects the way I look at history as well. I mean, when I talk about my 5 points of, you know, toward decolonizing architecture, which is supposed to be a pun on Le Corbusier's 5 points, because it's been 100 years. One of them is to just accept that time is not linear progression of individual styles and buildings. I mean, if it was that easy, great. You know, like I guess we have nothing much to do. We just have to list everything. But I mean, it seems a little bit more complicated than that. And even within the scale of a project, you know, the moment from any project is conceived until it's implemented. Wow. I mean, and then the things that happen in between. I mean, it's just, I wish we were in a free enough society in culture that allows multiple people, and I think this existed in many places that were deemed backwards. Because again, part of the process of modernity was to systemize time, to create timetables, to unify time, to say, this is how it works. And if you fit within that logic, welcome. If you don't, you're one of the crazies out there on the street and you have to put you to, you know, in an institution, you know, so there's just, I don't know, I'm meandering a bit, but I really do think it's time to, you know, allow for a plurality even, but like good luck asking for a plurality of conceptions of time in a whole culture and economy that pays you by the hour.
Exactly.
It's been so embedded. None of that should be accepted as normal or forever, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think especially in my teaching here and things I'm interested in, I think this idea of nonlinear time is the ultimate decolonial move. Mm-hmm. And because it embraced complexity and plurality in a way that I think these systems of ordering and classification and what gets allowed into the canon and what doesn't have constantly prevented that kind of complexity from being mm-hmm. dealt with. It's very easy to just, embrace this kind of very straightforward, simple, linear arrangement. But actually, what today's whole symposium is about is that it's much more interesting, but also inclusive and actually true to look at that complexity mm. and how so many things were happening simultaneously, but also were being used to influence one another across the geography we mm-hmm. occupy.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think the way you deal with time is something really fascinating that a lot of us could learn from in terms of how to engage with that complexity. Mm.
It's hard for me not to, when we go back to someone like Said Karim, you know, everything that I've had access to in terms of his professional work, that was about 30 years out of 94 years that he was alive. 50 years after his career had this incredible flourishing and production, he was alive, but he just sat around. I found his notebooks where he wrote a lot about things that even as a researcher student at the time, looking at these notebooks, I was like, oh, he must have lost his mind. Oh, now a decade later, I'm realizing, no, I just didn't get it then. Because it was, he was like writing about ancient Egyptians and lifestyle of the ancient Egyptians and how they relate to different thought patterns and tradition. I mean, this is what he spent 50 years on. And that's the stuff that one can argue, here's this great person, in my opinion, the majority of his time, that's what he spent of his living time, was writing these notebooks. That's not the stuff that's going to get mentioned or remembered. Even I don't know how to deal with it still. And then, you know, to spend 7 years under house arrest in your own design. I always found this to be such a fascinating thing. I mean, in a way, it's a luxury because at least you're trapped in your own design. But what's the conception of time for that person during that time? Like, what does that even mean? Anyway, so it's a big topic that we should be all invited to consider and pick at, as opposed to shun people from daring to, which happens a lot.
But I guess in the spirit of that, like thinking about time and thinking about the work that still needs to be done to move away from this linear systemic kind of ordering of information and knowledge, if there was one ill of the world that you could vanish, what would it be?
So I've come to accept that you don't know anything, without its contrary. You know, you don't know health without disease. You don't know strength without weakness. You don't know whatever without the opposite thing. And a lot of people, again, within the modern Western thinking would be like, oh, dualities. We don't talk about dualities. But, you know, well, again, I don't know. A lot of traditions that have lasted a lot longer than modernity have had not necessarily dualities, but this kind of notion of like two sides of the same coin. You know, even my current book that I'm writing on the objects from modern Egypt, which I stalled on for years, not just because life circumstances were strange, but it was a difficult book to organize. I ended up in the end drawing with these kinds of pairs, you know, wealth and poverty, past, present, and past. Because one can argue, oh, poverty is probably something that you would naturally want to say, let's get rid of poverty. It's probably doable, by the way. It's systemic that we should think that it's not doable. I mean, I probably sound like a dummy trying to distill it into a couple of words compared to like what's out there, you know, just human legacy and thinking about the theme that you need the yin for the yang, you need the... And, you know, one theory would say that the ill is not one thing or the other, but it's actually the inability to see how they each depend on each other. I think the inability and therefore the desire to control, maybe that's the ill.
Yeah.
Or
separate, potentially.
Separate.
Like to see them as extremes when actually they're... in quite close
mutual.
Proximity.
Yeah. I don't know. So I think, well, I guess, yeah, that did bring me to an answer that's a bit more straightforward. I would say the one ill that people should be more aware of is the obsession for control. You know, I don't think we can ever get rid of it. I think some people are just brought into this world to remind others that control is a thing, and how are you going to deal with it? How are you going to respond? You know, but it's going to be there. I don't know, but it's a way of seeing. I would say the issues are really about ways of seeing as opposed to the issues themselves. Because you can, you know, I think people need to liberate themselves from, I don't know, there's a very narrow way of seeing things that's really been pushed forward with everything from the media, education. And again, it's an ongoing, unfolding project within modernity for maybe a couple of centuries now, but with so much power consolidated in few hands, with so little transparency as to how things are actually operating. There's a lot of deception. Ooh, deception. That's an ill. That's an ill that we can get rid of. Deception. See, I got somewhere.
Yeah. But also control linked very nicely back to your narcissist detector invention.
Right.
So there's a theme in here.
There's a whole theme here. So maybe let's not get too philosophical about it. I mean, if there was one thing I would say, deception is horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you'll be pleased to know we're now on the quick fire round.
Yes.
So no thinking, just answering.
Yes, yes.
So morning person or night owl?
Morning.
What is your favorite season?
Summer.
Do you have a guilty pleasure?
Tarot.
Sorry, that threw me off.
I knew it will.
What is your most prized possession?
I learned to give up everything recently. So I actually there are some things that I still struggle to let go of. But I would actually say, going back to the theme of all my answers before, I don't want to put one thing as like my most prized possession.
I like it. You've been consistent. Mm. What was your first experience with the AA?
Oh, given my lecture here in 2018.
And could you describe the AA in one word?
A bookend for me personally, just because I was here in 2018. Now, and you know, there's been an interesting journey in between, so it does feel like a full circle.
I love a full circle moment.
I love full circles.
A great way to end our conversation.
That's right.
Thank you so much. This has been a real treat and also so thought provoking.
Thank you so much. I hope it's funny as well.
It definitely is. Our laughter alone. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Air AA podcasts are developed, recorded, mixed and edited by the Architectural Association from our home on Bedford Square in central London. To find more episodes, view the show notes and explore other Air AA series, visit air.aaschool.ac.uk.